First off, they should be wary about names that come out. Often the law enforcement officials are wrong. Another thing is there's almost never a second gunman.
Advice on how to consume news after a mass shooting. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Sitting in front of the flickering tube with your remote is so yesterday. Now there are myriad ways to get your fix.
Binge viewing on Netflix, original programming on Prime, Chromecast. I mean, the number of developments in the last year is just astonishing.
In Norway, they binge a bit differently. Picture a journey by boat, every uneventful second, live.
134 hours, 42 minutes, and 45 seconds.
And it sounds crazy, but people just got completely addicted to it.
There's more coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every time news breaks about a mass shooting, we see a flurry of downloads of a one-page postable sheet we wrote called the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook. It happened in May of this year after the shootings near the campus of the University of Santa Barbara, and then again in early June after another campus shooting in Seattle, and 2 weeks later after a high school shooting in Oregon. And even weirdly, after that Malaysian passenger jet was downed in Ukraine. Why? Because the news after a mass death is invariably wrong in key respects. Our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook first ran in September of 2013 after a shooting at the D.C. Navy Yards. Here's Wolf Blitzer.
Someone dressed in a black top, black jeans. What does that say, if anything, about a possible motive or whatever? Can we begin to draw any initial conclusions? And I want to alert our viewers, sometimes these initial conclusions can obviously be very, very wrong.
The initial coverage of the mass shooting at the Washington Navy Yard by contractor Aaron Alexis bore all the earmarks of classic reportage in the midst of these all-too-frequent horrors. It stunk.
We're looking at a situation possibly involving multiple shooters here at the Washington Navy Yard.
Wrong.
It's believed that whoever this gunman is, a man in his 50s who is carrying three weapons, a handgun, a shotgun, and an assault rifle.
Wrong about his age. Wrong about the assault rifle.
Earlier today, some media outlets were tweeting out that the shooter was a man named Raleigh Chance.
Now that is dangerously wrong. Breaking news, whether of a violent storm or a vicious gunman, creates chaos and confusion. That's a given. But what the news media do in the face of it, that's a choice. And they pretty much make the same choice in every medium, on every platform, in every era.
Rumors ran rampant. At first, it was thought that Vice President Johnson had also been shot in the attack.
During the JFK assassination, if you listen to the radio broadcasts, they sound as uncertain as Twitter reporters sound when they're reporting if he's alive, if he's dead.
Rebecca Greenfield writes for the Atlantic Wire.
A reporter in Dallas goes back and forth on it. At one point, they report that there were three shooters there. It goes all the way back to the reporting of the Titanic, even. There were false telegraphs saying that the Titanic hadn't sunk and that it was on its way to Halifax safe.
The new media environment means everyone gets to report or disseminate news of disaster. Some report well, some badly, but all are retweeted. So listen up. Some of this is on you.
When a breaking news situation is happening, you really should pay attention to certain key words that members of the media may use because they mean very distinct things.
Andy Carvin is the senior strategist on NPR's digital desk.
So for example, if they say, we're receiving reports that XYZ has happened, that should suggest to you that some of their sources are claiming something, but it's not necessarily confirmed. Whereas if they then say, we can confirm that such and such has happened, that means that they feel that their sourcing is strong enough that they can go out on a limb and claim that this is an actual fact. And there are all sorts of words that they may use in between, such as, it appears that such and such has happened. So they're feeling somewhat confident, but they still haven't necessarily confirmed it either.
What about CNN has learned?
One of the things that you will sometimes hear during breaking news is the phrase, CNN has learned or NPR has learned. While it may not seem like a big deal, it's their way of saying we have some sort of scoop. So on the one hand, it could mean that they do have a scoop and they're the first ones to confirm something. Or they're going out on a limb and reporting something that no one else has felt comfortable reporting yet.
A shooting where NPR got it initially wrong was reporting that Congressperson Gabby Giffords had died.
In a fast-changing news situation with conflicting reports, we should have been more cautious. NPR News apologizes to the family of Representative Giffords and to you, our listeners.
Which is why it's also important to listen to whether or not they're claiming what the source is. So, for example, if they say, we're receiving information from law enforcement sources or law enforcement officials, if they're not going on record with that law enforcement official's name, then it's still essentially speculation. Whereas if they say, officer such and such at a press conference 5 minutes ago said XYZ, that means the officials have gone on the record with their names and the information that they have.
Unnamed sources led CNN up the path to perdition by wrongly claiming a suspect had been apprehended in the Boston Marathon bombing. And unnamed officials wrongly fingered Ryan Lanza, the actual shooter's brother, as the gunman at Sandy Hook. But named officials maligned the citizens of New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. In the first hours of mayhem coverage, trust no one. News consumers longing for certainty should just learn to live with the pain. As Carvin says, mark our words, meaning the media's words, and learn from experience, even if we don't.
First off, they should be wary about names that come out, because often shooters are using different IDs, or often the law enforcement officials are wrong.
Ian Fisher is assistant managing editor for digital operations at the New York Times.
Be wary of organizations that blindly quote other organizations without solid sourcing. They aren't taking a very big chance in doing that. They can always say, oh, that was them, not us. Another thing is there's almost never a second gunman.
It's like House on the TV show saying it's never Lupus.
Right. It's it's never Lupus. There's almost never another gunman.
Craig Silverman, author of the Poynter Institute's Regret the Error blog, has just written a piece which he plans to run every time there's a crisis. It's called, This is My Story About the Breaking News Errors That Just Happened.
And it just basically will fit pretty much any breaking news error situation in the future.
Okay, so what happens every single time?
So misidentification of people, usually of victims of perpetrators, very consistent. We'll often see mistaken numbers in terms of the number of victims, in terms of the number of perpetrators, and that kind of thing as well. Sometimes location is incorrect, where something originated, where something is happening now. Mistakes also related to images. So fake images that are portrayed as real, or images that were taken previously and sort of find their way to be presented as if they're new. So that's very consistent as well.
As you note, big news brings out the fakers.
Absolutely. And this is a really important thing for both journalists and for people consuming media in these moments to realize is that there are lots of hoaxers who know that in this moment, people are just grabbing onto whatever image they can find. So they might Photoshop something and send it out. What we commonly see in weather situations is now what I call the street shark, where people will claim to see in a flooded street or highway a shark swimming. So beware of street sharks.
So who should we trust?
Well, a little bit of no one and a little bit of everyone. People on the ground, that's always your preferred source. Have they actually seen it with their own eyes? Are they actually there? And do they know the area? Really, really important.
But not guaranteed. I'm tempted now to play another montage here of bad reporting of the Boston Marathon bombing, the Sandy Hook shooting, the Oregon Mall shooting, the Aurora, Colorado shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting, and Columbine. But I won't, because the exercise would be more depressing than illustrative. Instead, we'll put a chart on our website to post by your TV or radio or computer to consult when next confronted with a blood-saturated lead. Because innocent people are shattered by guns, but also by the buckshot of frenzied media, social media included. Take note of the words. We're receiving reports, an unnamed official says. Another news outlet reports, experts speculate, and of course, second gunmen. Mostly, they're just buckets of blather deployed to fill that aching void. So print out our little chart, and may you never need it. But you will.
Coming up, in the brave new world of online watching, do you dare to stream?
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're devoting the next few minutes to some insights and discoveries we've made in the past year in the wide, wondrous world of television.
From Hollywood, it's Jimmy Kimmel Live after the Oscars.
If you caught Jimmy Kimmel's post-Oscar special back in March, you got to witness the torch being passed from the good old days to the brave new world. It began unremarkably with a big star and the obligatory clip.
Just a minute, please! He does not deserve
Francis,
a medal. I'm telling you that
I
man deserves
you.
To be taken out
I
and shot.
I'm begging you.
No.
Please.
No.
Do
I
not,
said just a minute!
Do not make a scene. Please.
The great Kevin Spacey promoting not a Hollywood movie or even a network TV show, but the pioneering Netflix streaming video series, House of Cards.
That's what a great show. I mean, you play a great villain.
Well, yeah, for those who have a stake in the status quo, broadcast television, for half a century America's dominant cultural force, has lost its primacy. On April 9th, 1979, a single episode of All in the Family entertained more than 40 million Americans. 35 years later, in a country with a 39% larger population, the first hour of primetime attracted the identical audience for the top five networks combined. The other 277 million Americans were doing something else. Some were on YouTube, watching cats play with parakeets, or perhaps watching internet personality Kingsley inveighing against bad baby names.
If I had been married for 5 years and we were about to finally have our child, and they woke up one morning and looked at me and said, I want to name our baby Bonquisha Charisse, I would be like, what the f***?
And still others might have checked out funnyordie.com to see Will Ferrell shouting at his 2-year-old landlord Pearl for the 81 millionth and first time.
Hi, Pearl.
Where's the rent?
You don't have to raise your voice.
You pay now!
I can give you half.
You pay now, bitch!
Goodbye, broadcast. Hello, broadband. For the past decade, it has been abundantly clear that the digital revolution was nudging the old model toward collapse. But what hasn't been clear is what will emerge from the rubble. Until maybe now.
It is moving at the speed of light.
Professor Jeffrey Cole is director of the Center for the Digital Future at USC's Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism.
Binge viewing on Netflix, original programming on Prime, Chromecast, a $35 dongle that can let you stream content from your phone or your tablet to your television set. I mean, the number of developments in the last year is just astonishing.
And it is by no means just the technology that's changing. The online successors to traditional TV stories are developed differently, promoted differently, monetized differently, and most of all, told differently.
This is Michael Bluth. For 10 years, he's worked for his father's company waiting to be made a partner. And right now, he's happy. This is Michael's mother.
Look what they've done, Michael.
She isn't happy.
Things only become good when they have to.
Mitch Hurwitz is the executive producer of Arrested Development, a groundbreaking comedy that nonetheless struggled on the Fox network. Though it attracted a cult audience delighted with its subversive humor, it never grabbed the lumpen' proletariat, who seemed to favor the raunchy one-liners on, say, 2 and a Half Men. Now, Arrested Development is a Netflix original. To Hurwitz, the structure of serialized streaming TV, often consumed binge style, offers the chance to develop story and character that episodic broadcast TV simply does not.
With a show that streams, you're really trying to set up as a creative person where you're going to be in 15 episodes. You're doing the things that a novelist does. And there's a reason that a short story can grab you more than a novel in the same amount of pages. The novel's building something bigger, perhaps. I think if you look at great shows in the last couple of years, they've had to endure a lot of criticism. Mad Men has really gone downhill. Breaking Bad, what happened to Breaking Bad? This season is awful. They've seen three. Right by the end of that season, they say, oh my God, this was the best thing ever, because they have now taken in the whole experience. That's what streaming allows.
Joe Lewis is head of comedy for Amazon Studios.
When we start a story, we're going to finish it, whether that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 seasons. And to me, that's what the new paradigm of TV is about. People will watch in order. And when they watch in order, that brings a whole other level of drama. It's compelling. It's like real life.
They're in Brave New World Part 2, the unprecedented ability to understand exactly what audiences want. And not mass audiences, but discrete clusters defined by personal tastes. Sure, the old methodology gave us All in the Family and Gunsmoke, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Lost. Mainly, though, overwhelmingly, it produced the likes of this.
Porter, that's my mother, dear. She helps me through everything I do, and I'm so glad she's here.
My Mother, the Car, circa 1966, sort of Norman Bates meets Mr. Ed, because if a man talking to his horse is hilarious, wouldn't it be twice as funny? It lasted one season. Amazon's Joe Lewis.
In the old days, there'd be most likely one person at a network and a small group of people around them that would watch the shows and, you know, off their best instincts would make a decision on what most of America would watch. We want to transcend that entirely and take people like myself out of the process.
Instead, Amazon Studios puts the audience in the process by sharing scripts and pilot footage on its website drawn from both Hollywood Usual Suspects and the world at large. In other words, an ongoing, massively multiplayer focus group.
Media has been held hostage to this notion that the only way or the best way you can possibly understand an audience is through its demographics.
Johanna Blakely is managing director of the Norman Lear Center at the Annenberg School.
There was this sense that you couldn't possibly understand what individual members of mass audiences were interested in, but if you knew a little bit about their age, if you knew their gender, if you knew how much money they made, where they lived, their race, you could make some assumptions about what their interests might be. And those interests might very well be associated with some purchasing behavior.
Hundreds of billions of dollars changed hands based on consumer behavior guesses pinned to little more than a zip code.
Nowadays, we're swimming in data, very detailed, granular data about what people care about, what they're looking for, what they're saying online, what they're buying, what videos they're watching. This very rich data will tell you something much more nuanced about what individual members of very large audiences are interested in. And let me tell you, they don't live in the same zip code. It's going to be a kid in Bangladesh who has the same interests as a kid in Queens, who has the same interests as an old guy in North Dakota who went up there to start fracking.
Case in point, Netflix, which for a decade has been refining an algorithm to make detailed recommendations based on users' viewing patterns, post-viewing ratings, and self-reporting about tastes and interests. It is no exaggeration to say that Netflix knows what you will like better than you do.
House of Cards was a safe bet for them. They were willing to spend $100 million to get that production off the ground because they already knew there was a certain Venn diagram there that overlapped fans of David Fincher movies, fans of Kevin Spacey, and people who had seen the original BBC House of Cards. So they knew that there was an audience there.
When Orange is the New Black producer Jenji Kohan approached Netflix with her true-to-life dramedy, she'd already been repeatedly turned away by premium cable. But Netflix ran the numbers and realized, likable female lead, check. Prison story, check. Black comedy, check. Hot, hot thespian action, check.
I have a prison wife.
What?
Her name is Crazy Eyes. Did she rape you?
No, she didn't rape me. But she held my hand.
I know that she pitched it to HBO and to Showtime, and they said, absolutely not. She went to Netflix, and they decided to do some research to see if there was actually an audience for it. And it turned out, oh my God, there is. Make it.
And the show is a hit, as long as you don't define hit by audience size or ad revenue. Netflix shows bring in zero ad revenue. What they do bring in is subscriptions to Netflix at $96 per year. In the fourth quarter of 2013 alone, the company signed on 2.3 million new subscribers. So yeah, Brave New World Part 3, alternate revenue models. In Netflix and Amazon's case, a very familiar one, what entertainment agent David Tochterman of Innovative Artists calls the cableization of the internet. Old movies and TV shows complemented with original programming.
HBO wasn't HBO until they started making original content. Same with Showtime, same with all these cable networks. House of Cards, I don't believe, would be able to be made if it was ad-supported.
In other quarters of the new streaming universe, ads have no place whatsoever. Technology enables performers to generate revenue directly from the consumer. No studio, no network, no aggregator, total disintermediation. An entirely new ecosystem.
I don't know if we fully appreciate the fact that we got out of the food chain. That is a massive upgrade. Because for every other living thing, life ends by being eaten. That's how all life ends, is every single life except human life. Every life ends like this.
Comedian Louis C.K. works in cable and does a robust business in live concerts, but he also streams comedy performances directly to viewers at $5 a pop. Nor is he alone in that sort of enterprise. Can we briefly go back to the Jimmy Kimmel special? A couple of minutes into Kevin Spacey's appearance, the two discussed the old Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Lo and behold, Kimmel said he'd appeared there 3 decades ago as a teenage magician.
Welcome, Amazing James. Can I call you Amazing?
No. I mean, yes, Johnny Carson.
I see. Are you a little nervous, Amazing?
No.
Yeah. It was a gag featuring Spacey's uncanny Carson impression. But here's the thing. That clip wasn't on Sunday's broadcast. Kimmel's viewers had to go find it online at a URL provided by the TV host himself.
And of course, on your website, kevinspacey.com,
yes,
you can see video of me on
right.
Johnny
that's
Carson show when yeah, I was Johnny a teenage Carson magician.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. What else is on that website?
What else is on the website? Aha. That would be the film Now. Spacey's documentary, which you can soon stream for $12.99 directly from kevinspacey.com. Now, advertising has by no means disappeared, even in the streaming economy. At Funny or Die, the business model resembles the Huffington Post. Big and not-so-big-name talent create videos gratis, getting their compensation psychically, while Funny or Die sells ad space against their content. CEO Dick Glover.
We will provide whatever support you want from a technical, from a writing, from a production point of view, whether you have something you want to promote, whether you have an idea that you've just really always cared about. What a great platform to do all that. So talent was very anxious to work with us.
Even though you actually never wrote them a check.
Never wrote them a check, correct.
Advertising also underwrites the rising stars of YouTube, among them the profane and perspicacious Kingsley, who covers rent and subsidizes college tuition on the strength of his more than 2.5 million channel subscribers and the ad revenue their eyeballs generate.
Kids be disrespecting their teachers, yelling at them, cursing at them, seeing news stories about like hitting them and spitting in their face. Like, really? Are you that against learning about the damn nucleus and some mitochondria?
Yep, with a potty mouth, irresistible smile, and about $2,000 worth of consumer technology, this 23-year-old has double the audience of On the Media. Because YouTube is not just a video player, it's a community. And thus the final Brave New World element of modern video. Even when advertising underwrites the medium, it almost never advertises the medium. That is now the province of digital word of mouth. Digital entertainment agent David Tochterman.
What has changed is the development of a social media ecosystem that actually is capable of driving audience to another platform.
You know, like from TV to social media to the streaming platform. One last time, back to Jimmy Kimmel. Turns out, not even network TV is some isolated biosphere. It's part of the new ecosystem, too. Kimmel himself has nearly 4 million followers on his YouTube channel. And on Sunday night, he didn't just chat with Kevin Spacey and plug his website. Though they were live on camera, they nonetheless posed for a selfie, which, with reference to Ellen's record-breaking Oscar selfie, they tweeted out.
By the way, our selfie has already broken the record set earlier.
Oh, yes. Fantastic.
You know, they got 1 million in the first hour.
Yeah.
We got 2 million.
Wow.
That's right. So congratulations.
Yes, congratulations. While some in show business will be caked in dust from the rubble of broadcast TV's inevitable collapse, others will bathe pristine and prosperous in the stream.
And now for something not completely different, reality TV. What's your pleasure? The competitive excitement of Dancing with the Stars? The histrionics of Real Housewives? The je ne sais quoi of Duck Dynasty? Or maybe what you'd prefer is just a little peace and quiet. Like 18 hours of Scandinavian salmon fishing. You know, they love it in Norway. The Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation specializes in some of the world's most boring and, in Norway, most popular television. Rune Myklebust is head of programming at the network. When I spoke to him last summer, he told me that the slow TV movement started in 2009 with a program that showed a train ride through the Norwegian countryside from the train's perspective.
It was supposed to be 7 hours and 4 minutes, but because of a signal trouble in one of the tunnels before the end station, it turned out to be 7 hours and 14 minutes.
And people loved it, right?
Enormously. We've never received so much attention during a program before. It was amazing.
Your next slow program was the ferry ride special.
Yes. Because 7 hours is not very long compared to about 134 hours. 5.5 days. There's a ferry ride that goes every day, leaves every day from Bergen on the western coast of Norway and goes up to the far north, close to the Russian border, a city called Kirkenes. It's been doing that for over 100 years. So it's perfect for slow TV. And this time we wanted to do it live.
Uh-huh.
Because the train ride, that was a recording. So doing it live, we thought that people had the opportunity at least to wave to the program as it sailed by.
Roughly 5 days, run live continuously over the secondary public broadcasting channel. Therefore, no other programming was on that channel, just this ferry ride.
134 hours, 42 minutes, and 45 seconds. And it sounds crazy, but people just got completely addicted to it. They started to show up at the harbors, along the route, on the mountains and waving with flags. And the Queen showed up at the end in her royal yacht waving to us. So it turned out to be a huge national event.
So the 7 hour special got a 15% market share, which was way more than you'd normally get. This one got a 36% market share, right?
That's correct, yeah.
That's incredible for a 5 day show. And so somewhere along the line, you had something called National Firewood Night.
Mm-hmm. First 4 hours of ordinary, but a little bit slow, produced television with guests and some poetry and music and wood chopping competitions and stuff like that. And then around midnight, we just cooled down, went into the stove and just saw the wood burning for about 8 hours.
Our own Stephen Colbert actually remarked on your show, on his show, The Colbert Report. Let me play you that.
I've got my eye on a wildly popular program from Norway called National Firewood Night, which consisted of mostly people in parkas chatting and chopping in the woods, and then 8 hours of a fire burning in a fireplace. It destroyed the other top Norwegian shows like So You Think You Can Watch Paint Dry and The Amazing Glacier Race.
That's a great piece. I've seen it.
So how'd you feel? Honored?
Of course, definitely, yes.
Is it possible to make slow TV too slow?
I would like to explore that to find out. It's very important to push the limit a little bit.
So how are you pushing the limit?
we would like to do sort of a national knitting night. It's going to be knitting all night.
That is definitely pushing the limit. What's the wildest idea or one of the weirdest suggestions that anyone has made to you for a slow TV show?
A day in a snail's life. But there's one very weird idea that's actually very exciting, and that is watching the watch, the time. Everybody has a feeling of time. You follow the time during the day, but you don't actually sit down and look at it for more than a couple of seconds just to see what it is. So if we can get people to relax, that would be very fun.
This kind of television is a different experience from the kind of diversion that we're used to. Is it intended to be more meditative, like yoga, or is it just another form of entertainment, only slower?
People like it for different reasons. We're not doing this because we want to change how people look at television. We just want to tell stories and explore new ways of doing that. A lot of the audience say they love this because it's so meditative. They were supposed to watch for 3 minutes, they were sitting for 3 hours. It's so exciting, although it's, nothing is happening. And a lot of the audience say it's so different from everything else. It's so relaxing. That's why they watch it, because the other thing is going too fast. And of course, some people like wood, some people like the ferry, some people are train nerds. People watch it because of that as well. It's a lot of different reasons why people watch it. And I think there's also a lot of different reasons why we do it.
Runa, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Runa Myklebust is head of programming at the Norwegian Broadcasting Company.
Coming up, some wacky and weirdly prescient predictions for the future of newspapers.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As any regular OTM listener knows, we often discuss the present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
But rarely do we visit the past to see what folks thought future business models might be. For instance, in a late 1960s TV special about the 21st century house, Walter Cronkite tackled the future of newspaper delivery. He got it half right, I guess.
This equipment here will allow him to carry on normal business activities without ever going to an office away from home. This console provides a summary of news relayed by satellite from all over the world. Now, to get a newspaper copy for permanent reference, I just turn this button, and out it comes.
Matt Novak writes a blog for the Smithsonian called Paleo Future, about futuristic forecasts from the past. We spoke to him a year ago after he wrote a piece about old predictions for the future of the newspaper.
Some of the pictures that we get from past visions of the future have to do with the newspaper that would be delivered by radio. Fax papers, as they were called, were actually trialed in the 1930s and 40s, where you would have this machine that you'd set up in your house. But given the spectrum it was using, it could only be used from midnight to 6 a.m. So you had this loud, clattering machine that would print out a newspaper while you were sleeping. A lot of the other predictions had to do with pneumatic tube delivery. That pneumatic tubes were a very popular vision of the future. Actually, the Boston Globe predicted in 1900 that not only would laundry or your ready-made lunches get delivered via pneumatic tube, but also your evening newspaper.
The bad guesses are entertaining. The prescient looks at the future are kind of jaw-dropping. You have written about a December 1900 issue of the New York World daily newspaper. It quoted the editor of another newspaper, the London Daily Mail, predicting the centralized national newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. Alfred Harmsworth, the editor of the London Daily Mail, was saying in 1900, I feel certain that the newspaper of the 20th century will be drawn into the vortex of combination and centralization. He goes on to say, in other words, where there are now a multitude of papers, good, bad, and indifferent, there will be then one or two great journals.
You've written about a 1994 video from Knight Ridder, which had a laboratory dedicated to developing the future. We're talking about 19 years ago, still pretty much the infancy of the internet, but they describe the iPad.
Tablets will be a whole new class of computer. They'll weigh under 2 pounds. They'll be totally portable. They'll have a clarity of screen display comparable to ink on paper. We may still use computers to create information, but we'll use the tablet to interact with information. Reading, watching, listening.
What's interesting about that Knight Ridder video is that it was actually used in the Apple versus Samsung patent war of the century here. You know, Apple sued Samsung saying that they were copying their designs for their phones and their tablets. And Samsung countered with, well, here's prior art. You know, this is your iPad. So it's interesting to see these sorts of futuristic concepts pop up in real world disputes over intellectual property.
The tablet in the Knight Ridder video showed a newspaper on the page. It shows being able to click through to more details in the story. It showed being able to click through to video. It showed related stories that were immediately loaded onto the page. Just kind of nailed it. But it got one thing hilariously wrong.
We envision kiosks that will download your publications onto electronic cards that go inside the tablet. So if you're doing business in Miami, but your hometown is Denver, you can still get your local paper delivered every morning.
Completely missed. Completely missed. In the internet age, the notion of internet distribution of every paper.
Well, things like wireless delivery of newspapers were still the realm of sci-fi. There's a lot of accounts from the early 90s where people just didn't believe that broadband Wi-Fi would be a reality even within, you know, 20 years.
So you have made a study of these artifacts. I'm curious to know what your favorite prediction is, accurate or off target.
I often go back to the Jetsons. You know, they obviously had the jetpacks, the flying cars, the meal pills. They also had dedicated machines for every different technology that today we have sitting in our pockets, whether that was the video phone or whether that was the newspaper machine. You know, it descended from the ceiling and George sits down in his comfortable chair and reads the newspaper.
I guess the only thing the smartphone does not do is give you a dog treadmill outside the apartment. Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog for Smithsonian.com.
And now, a leap into modernity. Marshall Berman, the great philosopher of modernism, died in the fall of 2013 at the age of 72 of a heart attack while eating breakfast with a friend at a diner in the city he loved, New York. It seems, if much too soon, at least fitting, he died in dialogue. He believed dialogue to be an urgent need in modern times because our subjectivity and inwardness have intensified, a state he called both richer and more lonely. That's why, he wrote, communication is both a desperate need and a primary source of delight. In a world where meanings melt into air, these experiences are among the few solid sources of meaning we can count on. One of the things that make modern life worth living is the enhanced opportunities it offers us, and sometimes even forces on us, to talk together, to reach and understand each other. Meanwhile, the argument over the internet's power to intensify our inwardness versus its ability to engender dialogue never ends. But the intrepid Clive Thompson has conducted a thorough search of the digital landscape and makes his case for the latter in his book, Smarter Than You Think: How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He's come a long way from where he began as a geekily engaged 25-year-old back in the 90s.
So I guess it was probably around 94, 95 when people started coming online in droves. And I thought, well, this is terrible because, you know, the average person is so silly and trivial that this is going to destroy all standards of discussion. And we're sort of to have nonstop pop culture crap instead of good conversation. And I was convinced that the average person could not be trusted with the keys to the internet.
Here you were, a mere babe in your 20s, and you're screaming at the kids to get off your lawn?
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of 25-year-old men are pretty sure of their opinions. When you sit at your desk, it's easy to believe that the average person is really stupid and the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But when you start reporting and actually going out there and talking to people and seeing what they do, I think the reporting saved me because I just realized that a lot of the things I was worried about, they came to pass, some of them, but they weren't as bad as I thought, and I did not at all predict the amazing stuff.
You launched the book with the story of supercomputer Deep Blue beating Garry Kasparov at chess, which is a moment that was seen as a Rubicon when human brain power fell short. But as you go on to report, the answer to the question, who's smarter, humans or computers, is both.
That's right, because what Kasparov did next is really interesting. He put together a new form of chess called advanced chess, where you have one human and a laptop facing down against another human and a laptop. The humans could do what they're good at, which is, you know, intuition, rattling their opponent, and the computers could take care of if-then possibilities and letting them consult the history of chess. So normally chess players are somewhat conservative. They stick to a very simple line of play they do over and over again. And what happened was that the chess suddenly became unbelievably complicated and creative and daring. And this really is the metaphor for what I do in the book, where I'm trying to say, what does it mean when we stop thinking in isolation and start thinking with each other and with computer assistance?
What you call in the book the centaur, the man-machine meld that creates, if not a super being, at least a better skilled one.
Yes. It's been one of the more remarkable things to observe what happens on a daily basis. I mean, every time someone goes on Facebook and says, does anyone know this? And a bunch of people who they have sort of forgotten that they even know happen to notice this at the corner of their eye and chime in. That's collaborative thinking in its most simple form. One of the things that's great about thinking out loud is that you begin to realize that there are other people who you would never have predicted are thinking about the same thing as you. Scientists actually have a phrase for this. They call it multiples, where two or three different scientists will come up with the exact same idea at the exact same time all around the world without knowing of the other's existence.
Like, you know, Newton and Leibniz and the calculus?
Yep. Or like Charles Darwin with the theory of evolution. He invented it and then he sat on it for years until he got a letter from another young academic saying, I have this idea. I think you're interested in this stuff too. The typewriter was invented at least five or six times, the telescope by four people, the logarithm by two different people, and always within a year of each other. So there's something about our environment that means that ideas come to life when they're sort of ready to come to life.
And so how does the digital environment influence that?
It's fantastic because in the old days, people worked in isolation before realizing someone else around the world had the answer faster than them. In fact, studies of mathematicians found that one-third of them complained that they were toiling on something and they published it only to discover that someone a few cities away had the answer 2 years earlier, right? Mm. So knowing about what is going on in other people's minds helps resolve multiples and get those problems solved more quickly, or even just find someone to talk to about them.
Okay. But what about the children? Let's not forget the children. How do they learn to write if all they're ever producing are texts on their phones? And by the way, get off my lawn.
Again, get off my lawn, exactly. Young people definitely are writing a lot of stuff online, and a lot of it is quite silly, and there's all those short forms and whatnot. But practice is valuable, and it is hard to get young people to write stuff because when they went into school and you have to write an essay for the teacher, you don't really want to do it because there's no actual audience. There's an audience of one person, it's your teacher, and they're being paid to read your writing, so it's inauthentic. And every teacher has known this, and every student has known this, and that's why it's been historically really hard to get them to write. What has happened as, you know, young people have gone online and done what the rest of us have done, which is to realize, oh my goodness, there's these people I can talk to. They're my friends, they're strangers, there's different forums. They started writing more than any generation has ever done in the past. Now, that idea that we are now talking and taking the thoughts out of our heads and putting them down and showing them and sharing them to other people is really one of the central trends throughout the whole book. And it has been persistently misunderstood, I think, by traditional scholars and journalists and thinkers because they're accustomed to writing and putting their ideas in public. In reality, for the rest of the population, it's transformatively new.
But all that minutiae, Charlie's choice of entree, all that living out loud, what's the value of that for the rest of us?
You know, one tweet about one's lunch is kind of boring, but 300 of them starts to become oddly compelling in a weird way because I begin to get the sense of the contours of what's going on in my friend's life, particularly if they're, you know, they're talking about what they've seen, what they've read. It's called ambient awareness. It's the idea that if you pick up these little subtle cues into the work of someone else's mind, you begin to have a fantastic sense of what's happening in their intellectual life. And that has enormous value when you are trying to solve problems by knowing who's out there that you can talk to, when you can establish states of awareness amongst a group, where the group has a sense of its own abilities.
My favorite part of the book, probably, is the big chunk that's devoted to memory in the digital age. You wrote that the real power of digital memories is to trigger our human memories. But if you can't access this mountain of material that you've recorded and stored, if you can't sort through it, then it's no good to us at all, is it? In fact, you cite a study that suggests if we know something is recorded, we'll forget it even sooner. So is this a real risk in the end?
It's definitely a concern. Any parent knows that when their child is born, they start taking, you know, one picture every 5 minutes. And then after, you know, about a month, they've got 3,000 pictures and they're never going to look at them again.
And the right? Second child has no pictures.
The second child has no pictures. The more I looked at the profusion of recording we're doing, the more I learned that really one of the great skills of the next, you know, 20 to 30 years, we're going to have to learn how to deal with the enormous stores of memory we have and how to manage them so they're useful. A lot of this is going to become almost like library science of everyday life. You know, librarians 500 years ago began to grapple with there being tons of books and they had to start thinking about how to prioritize them. And now we have to do that too.
And what about distraction? The last great criticism of this digital age, which is that it's like flickering lights on the periphery, and that is death to creativity.
I think that's actually right. That's the one criticism that I wholeheartedly endorse. I mean, the idea that digital media are making us trivial or shallow, I don't buy at all. We've been very good at being trivial and shallow for centuries. I certainly was before the internet came along. But the idea that we are now more distracted, I think, is absolutely true and is borne out by the research. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are trying to do too much at a time on these little devices. You know, you open up your phone or your computer, and it's not really a single phone or a single computer. What it really is a gateway to about 6 or 7 multinational companies that are trying to grab your eyeballs and sell you ads. So they're constantly sending you these alerts saying, please look at me, you know, please do this. And when I first started working on the book, I thought maybe there's some amazing high-tech solution for this, right? Like maybe there's some software out there that could save us from all these distractions. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized there is no silver bullet. There is really only, you know, what the philosophers of attention have always called mindfulness. And this is really what I'm writing about here. I mean, if you grant the force of my argument that these new technologies catalyze and push us into new types of thinking that are productively useful, right? You know, connected thinking, social thinking, that it's also good to think in the non-digital ways that we enjoyed for decades before. You know, the more solitary thinking, face-to-face interactions, and you need to build that into your life. I mean, you know, religious traditions and unions had it right when they pushed for the weekend Sabbath, right? You know, they understood 7 days a week of being always on is a bad thing. Now, I'm not a monk about this. I actually, if someone asks me a question I can't answer, I Google it on the weekends, and I do text a lot. But by and large, I've tried to sort of do the Sabbath, and it works pretty well for me.
You don't play video games on the weekends?
Oh, yeah, I play video games on the weekends. I've recently gotten into what's known as Japanese bullet hell games.
I'm glad you really unplug and kick back on your Sabbath.
I read books, too.
Clive, thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun.
Clive Thompson is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. I think that the departed bard of modernism, Marshall Berman, would have deemed Clive a modernist. In his masterwork, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, Berman wrote that, quote, to be modern is to experience personal and social life as a maelstrom, to find one's world and oneself in perpetual disintegration and renewal, trouble and anguish, ambiguity and contradiction, to be part of a universe in which all that is solid melts into air. To be a modernist is to make oneself somehow at home in the maelstrom, to make its rhythms one's own, to move within its currents in search of the forms of reality, of beauty, of freedom, of justice that its fervid and perilous flow allows.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurakhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Meera Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.